This is an interview with Andy Sebastian by Caroline Pascoe, with Katie Murphy recording for the Women's Information Service Oral History Project at the State Library for South Australia on Friday the 20th of April 2018. Welcome, Andy.
Hi, Caroline, thank you.
Just a brief look at where you were born and where you grew up, please.
I was born in the early 1950s and I grew up in the South Australian countryside. So I was a country girl and came to Adelaide to go to university. So I came to Adelaide to live, I can't remember, it was 69, something like that, to go to university, and did a Bachelor of Arts at Flinders University.
The 1970s was a exciting time for women.
Yep.
Just the second wave of feminism and all those sorts of things. What was the situation for women in the 70s from your experience that maybe prompted you to start looking at the social position?
I think what really influenced me was actually the situation of women in the 60s. So growing up in the South Australian countryside, observing women whose marriages broke down, for example, and they couldn't leave their husbands and take their children. And so women stayed in situations of extreme violence, extreme unhappiness. The Married Women's Property Act wasn't revoked until, I can't remember when, but something like 69. And so when I was growing up as a teenager, observing, and you know, teenage girls really look at what's happening, they're very observant, and what I saw was that women couldn't work, often without the permission of their husbands, and that was true in my own family. Probably shouldn't go there too much, but you know, typically if a woman wanted to work part-time, if her husband was a man of some authority in the town, or then if he didn't want her to work, she wouldn't be working. Women going to the bank to try to get loans, women trying to leave unhappy situations with their kids. This was, my growing up was pre the Family Law Court and the Family Law Act, which made a huge difference. So coming into the 70s, I mean, I was just a young woman coming into the 70s. In 1970, I was at university, I can't remember which year. And so in all sorts of ways, it was so much fun because it was an explosion of a whole generation of us coming into adulthood at the same time as Anne Summers wrote Damned Whores and God's Police. Simone de Beauvoir had written The Second Sex. My goodness, my brain is going on.
Betty Friedan,
exactly. So there was all this theoretical work that was happening that was at the same time as the reality for us was very different. And another really big thing for me, I think, was being involved in the Vietnam moratorium. And it was both a time when some of us came into our political realisation, but it was also a time when we were starting to feel equal with the young men of our time, but we weren't. You know, they were still the organisers, they were still this, they were still that. I think the other two things that very much influenced my growing up, and maybe again specifically because I was growing up in a country town, the treatment of Aboriginal people. One of the girls I went to school with, her dad had a gammy leg and was something of a drinker. And it was only as a teenager that I discovered the story behind that. He was a man who was very community-minded, working on a working bee. Apparently, they were cutting down trees And I don't know how it happened, but whether the tree fell on him or he was cut or what have you. But as a result, according to the story I grew up with, as a result of improper treatment in the hospital, his leg went gangrenous and he lost it. So observing how adults in the town treated him, and that stayed with me. And one of the other things that happened was I just got to university, and Udjuru Nununku, who is the Aboriginal poet who at that stage was known as Kath Walker, came to Flinders University. You know, I was a country kid with eyes wide open, so I was going to everything. And I had, as a teenager, like 15, I think, discovered her poetry. And I remember seeing her name up. I could not believe it was the same woman. I kind of didn't care who it was. But the very fact, Kath Walker, you know, that name. And I went, and that was a huge political thing for me too. And then finally, I think the other thing that really was happening to me, just coming up a little bit more towards the time of the invention of the switchboard, was in my immediate family. I had a sister who was involved in a car accident with her very young child and acquired a disability. And so disability had always been part of my awareness, but I think the particular situations meant that I was never really exposed to the social aspects of disability. And then, of course, you know, the year of the disabled persons was, I forget exactly what, maybe 1975. And so this political movement at the same time as I was discovering through personal experience the obstacles for people with a disability. So, you know, it was, and also I have to say the other thing that was a huge factor in my level of awareness and my growing up and my social commitment was my grandmother. Both my grandparents were very interested in politics. My grandfather was, and I lived with them through most of my adolescence. My grandfather was a member of state parliament for a few years, and he was on the local council, so he was that kind of interest in politics. But my grandmother was a lifelong player, really, in the Country Women's Association. And the year I was born, she was then national president, and she was awarded an MBE for her services to women and children throughout Australia. And one of the things I loved, because 17, 18, I hitchhiked, you know, all over the place, as we did at that stage. And, it was kind of game that I would always go to the women's restrooms in country towns throughout Australia, and sure enough, I was finding my grandmother's name on foundation stones. And of course, the funny background to that was, I mean, my grandfather was a grazier, and by then they'd come through the Depression and stuff, and he had enough means, and so he often would hire a small plane if grandma wanted to go somewhere. And so many stories. My grandmother was terrified of flying. Terrified, what, like you would not believe. And she'd be in these little mosquito planes.
So she was a strong woman.
She was a strong woman because she was utterly determined. You know, if the school of the air in some moon or whoop-whoop wanted her to go, she'd get on that plane, no matter how scared she was.
Well, so I can see you've come from very good stock, and we've got a really good idea of what the young Andy Sebastian was. Can you now take me to how you came involved with the Premier's Department?
Okay. Well, first of all, I have to take you to my habit, as it had already become, I had my degree, I'd been working, my habit was save up as much money as I could and then travel. And so I was travelling in the United States of America and having a great time. I went with two girlfriends, and the sister of one of the girls and her husband lived in America. And it was a couple of wonderful things. We landed in Atlanta, Georgia, and they knew I loved jazz, and they had bought me a ticket to Ella Fitzgerald's return concert to Atlanta, the first time she'd returned there since, apparently, you know, there was an incident with, you know, the Klan some many years before. That was pretty amazing. Anyway, so we had a good time, travelled around America, went to New York. I love New York. And then we went to San Francisco, where we ran out of money. And, you know, it was not surprising, run out of money. I had enough sense, I had a return ticket. But I was also locked into that date. So being able to eat and sleep safely for, I can't remember how long it was, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, I don't remember, was a bit of an issue. And so, you know, we talked to people, you know, Australian kids talk to everybody. And we discovered that there were a number of ways that you could quite safely survive on the streets in those days. One of them was called panhandling. And it's basically, it's the equivalent of the charity collectors. So you're given a tin and a badge and a permit, and you go out on the street and you collect for this charity, and at the end of the day you get to keep half of what you've collected. And so, you know, this is, what is it, I don't know, 1976, beginning of 77, I can't remember, something like that. And so, you know, you could get a bed for $5 a night, I don't know, $6 or $7 you could eat two or three times a day, so that was all right. And so we started doing that, and one of the other girls was terrific at that. I was not great at that. I didn't like that. But, you know, I ploughed through it for a few days, but then I kept asking people, what else were the options? And you could work in the childcare centre, so I did. And there were the trucks that came every day to pick up labourers. So I lined up there a few times, but I very quickly worked out they'd only take men. And then I had the sense to follow the lead. Who on earth set all this up? Because what I was observing, everybody else was just kind of, I have to say my friends carried me a bit at this point, because they were intent on acquiring the means. Oh, of course, blood, selling your blood was a big thing. And it was only $5 in New York, I think, but it was $11 a pint in San Francisco. And I can tell you straight away, that was where I discovered I'm a nightmare. One of my friends, who's an Italian girl, fabulous veins, they'd hook her up and her blood's going whoosh, 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 whoosh. It'd take them forever to find the blood in me and it would crawl. So I was hopeless at that. But while, so I gave that up after the first time. That was just agonising. I'd be there for an hour and they still haven't got enough blood. So what I did while the others were giving blood was talk and listen and ask a lot of questions. And so I discovered this absolutely amazing story. All of this was organised through a place called the Haight-Ashbury Switchboard. And that was started by two guys, one of whom I met, who they were older black men, and they had, you know, they were very community-minded men. They understood absolutely information was power and their people weren't getting it. So they did the equivalent of shinning up a stoby pole and tap the wires. I mean, they don't have stoby poles in San Francisco, but, you know, they had this little jerry-built switchboard, literally, which they had tapped the wires, and they started off in this kind of cupboard, really. By the time I got there, it was a room about this size, and it was staffed almost entirely by young people travelling from around the world. And they had created, they had, you know, all these different phone lines, and they had the women's switchboard, the dental switchboard, the health switchboard, the education switchboard. Like, it was just gobsmacking. It was the most fantastic experience. So I returned to Australia having...
Did you work at all with, excuse me interrupting, did you work at all at that, in that area?
No, because they didn't really, you know, like they wanted people who were going to stay, and I absolutely was not. I had the return ticket. But what I did do, because I met this one of the older guys, and he was happy for me to hang around. And so I did. I hung around and I talked to some of these backpackers who'd come, and like there was this one guy. He was a huge guy. He was English. He had arrived, I think it was 7 or 8 years before. He had no intention of staying beyond 3 weeks, and he was still there, you know. And he was an amazing guy. He'd really, yeah. So I came back to Australia with no money. And in those days, Centrelink was a very different beast. And it was actually quite civilised if you were tertiary educated. They had, what was it called? The Commonwealth Employment Service, I think. And it was this fabulous bloke. I'd gone to him because I had this pattern of I'd get a fabulous job and I'd stay there and save my money, then I'd go travelling. So I'd come back and I'd have nothing to go to. So, you know, I'd kind of worked my path to this place, and this man was great. He always knew about good jobs. Anyway, so I went to see him and said, I've got no money, I need work really fast, and something that pays well would be very good. And he said, oh my God, he said, there's one here that absolutely looks exactly like you, but I think they've just closed it. And I said, well, you got anything else? And he said, no, I don't at the moment. He said, look, give them a go, you never know, and come back next week. Now, I'm not 100% sure. If there's anybody who really knows this story, it'd be Maureen Fallon, and she would remember. But I think it might have been a Friday that he said that. So he said, give him a go, and then, you know, if nothing happens, come back next week, and I'll see if I've got something else. So I whizzed out and rang, and I think it was, like, even late in the afternoon, and I got Maureen Fallon. And I said, you know, what was his name? Bill or something like that. Anyway, I've been to the office and they've given me this job description for an information officer in the women's advisory unit, and I'd like to apply. And she said, well, I'm afraid we've just closed it. And I said, oh, that's a shame. And I just didn't stop talking. And a few minutes later, she said, oh, I think we need to talk to you. Bless her. I was so grateful to her because I thought, oh, yes, okay, here's a chance. So as I say, I'm not sure, but I reckon that was a Friday, because I think we were eating potatoes that had grown in the garden while we were travelling. And anyway, so I went for the interview and I got it. And I think I got it largely because of some of the stories and experience that I alluded to at the beginning, because, and in those days, I think, you know, like, even when I was at university, it's just suddenly come back into my mind, I was living in Glenelg in one of those little back streets in a house that was being condemned, so it was cheap enough for me to live in with some other students. And there was a series of tiny houses and big fence across the laneway. And I remember hearing what was utterly clear to me was domestic violence happening in Italian across that place. And so I developed a habit of whenever the violence started, I would go and accost the best looking young man in the street and say, come with me. And we'd walk along the alleyway talking loudly. And of course, and I'd ask him random questions, it didn't matter what. As soon as the man in the house could hear a man's voice in the alley, he quietened down. And then one night I couldn't find anybody. And so I waited, because I'd realised by now there was a pattern. And I waited until the morning, and I went and knocked at the door. And it had been a shocking fight that night, and the woman's hand was broken. And she didn't speak very much English, and I didn't speak very much Italian, but, you know, we kind of got it together, and I got her to the hospital, and I took her kid to school, and then she had one or two little ones, I forget now. But anyway, I started teaching her English. And she started bringing a couple of other friends. So, you know, stories like that were what got me the job. And so I started working at the switchboard.
But no, you were information officer.
I started working at the Women's Advisory Unit. And in fact, that's right, the obstacle to my getting the job, the one obstacle was the salary was $8,000, and it was under one of those government support schemes that were around at the time. It was a fabulous scheme, I forget what. The government gave the employer so much to employ somebody for so long. Again, Maureen would remember the detail of that, I don't. But that was for a non-tertiary educated role. And I said, I didn't say anything about having a degree. Forget I've got a degree. I thought, $8,000, that's a fine salary. So I started working at the Women's Advisory Unit. Thank you for that correction, Caroline. And my job really was, I was sitting at a desk, had a telephone, and women, see, Deborah McCulloch, who's the women's advisor, used to say that when she was appointed as women's advisor to the Premier and government had one view of what the role should do. The women of South Australia had quite another view. And she was spot on when she said that, because women would ring her and say, well, you're the women's advisor. I need you to do this or that. So it was those calls that came to me as the information officer. So women would ring me up about anything, absolutely anything. Top of the list, though, were social security, family law, stuff to do with children, you know, and education, neighbourhood disputes, you name it.
Domestic violence?
Oh, yeah, domestic violence.
And accommodation?
Yeah. Accommodation, not so much while I was at the unit. So there was enough scope, and one of the things I discovered really quickly, this was no job for one person, because these were serious issues, right? And so I'd take a call, or I'd take any number of calls, and then once, you know, half the public service is going home for the night, I'm sitting there actually working out what phone calls I've got to make, who I can find, you know, and we didn't have Google at this stage, so I had to use all my networks. So I remember this woman, I forget what the issue was. I know it was a really hard one, but she was out in Neil Blewett's electorate. And Neil had been my politics lecturer at the university. And so, you know, first thing next morning, there I am on the phone ringing his electoral office to find out, you know, who we can talk to, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, like sometimes I was working 16 hours a day. It was a lot. But also I was talking to Deborah and the other women in the unit about the calls that were coming through. And Deborah decided that what we would do was do a quick kind of, I don't know what you'd call it, run around the state and talk to women about what are the key issues, you know, because that's part of her strategic planning. She had, at that stage, she had Julie Ellis working on part-time work. And in fact, I think Maureen might have also been working on part-time work. And Cheryl, I forget her surname, but she was an amazing woman, and she was doing some economic modelling and stats and what have you. And I think Deborah was trying to work out, okay, what are the big picture issues that are really facing the women of South Australia, and what's the direction?
When you say run around, did you mean phone around, or
visit,
fly out and visit?
So we flew to Coober Pedy, we flew to Mount Gambier. I think we drove through much of the southeast, maybe the upper southeast. Anyway, and we went to, you know, CWA meetings, and we had meetings in town halls and what have you. And that was pretty interesting. But actually, I think for me, it was also more of what I was hearing on the phone. So by this stage, I'm thinking, okay, this is not a job for one person. I do not want to spend my life here. This is too hard. There are real issues here, and I was absolutely recognising that the issues that my mothers, my sisters, my cousins were experiencing, these were the issues that women of South Australia were having. And I knew, because I'd been helping my mother, my sisters, my cousins, how much time it takes to deal with some of those issues, and I knew no one person could do it. And then when Deborah and I did this thing around, I was thinking, you know, like Deborah had her own need to do that level of strategic planning, but I thought we've got to have something that is going to answer this. And I'd always been really interested in the Citizens Advice Bureau. You know, like as a country kid, you knew about the Citizens Advice Bureau, and if any auntie or grandma or anything was to give you advice, they'd say, if you don't know where to go, ring the Citizens Advice Bureau. And, you know, country people who got off the train in Adelaide and had to go to, you know, the hospital, the children's hospital or something, could always rely on the Citizens Advice Bureau. They were amazing. And so my very first thought when I started thinking, this is crazy, why is one person doing this? I thought, well, why aren't the Citizens Advice Bureau doing this? And I actually went and loitered, really, in the Citizens Advice Bureau for a day or so, and started to realise, now, this wasn't going to crack it. And I met with one of the most amazing women, Marion Disney. She ran the CAB in South Australia. Certainly in Adelaide.
Where was it?
It was maybe the town hall or somewhere like that. It was in town, and it had little CABs, you know, like Elizabeth and Port Adelaide and what have you. Anyway, so Marion Disney explained to me the charter of the CAB and its roots in the UK and da-da-da-da-da, and it was abundantly clear to me that much as I regarded it as the most wonderful service in the world, it wasn't going to meet the specific needs of, you know, couldn't go far enough. And so I started to think about, right, so how can I do this? And I was very much centred here in the South Australian, the Adelaide context. But I started thinking of those blokes in San Francisco. And the thing that I think triggered those thoughts most of all was when I met that man, I actually recognised in his stories about doing stuff for his community, completely different. He's a black American man, completely disadvantaged, da-da-da-da-da, but smart and had managed to get an education. Whereas me, I'm completely privileged, white, you know, da-da-da. So in those ways, no commonality, but actually we really liked each other and we really got on, and it was him who said, you know, you're just like me, the way you talk about your mothers and your sisters and the things you're doing, you are just like me. And I mean, I felt flattered at the time because I just thought he was amazing. But
so he triggered the idea of the switchboard.
Well, that's right. The thing about that thing that he said, that you're like me, what he was talking about was that way of working. And what I understood from that was that the communities in San Francisco and South Australia were not so very different if we wanted to be a community. Mm-hmm. And the thing that was striking about women in South Australia at that time in our history was that we were quite a community. Like we were, you know, like if you think about the dialogue at that time, back to your question of the 70s, you know, we were, as the country women, the National Council of Women, the radical lesbians, you know, like there's all these very different groups of women, and we were all starting to work out what was the women's agenda. So we did have a bit of a sense of solidarity because we were also coming to terms with the fact that women weren't being paid the same as men, even when they were doing the same work. And, you know, women didn't have the same rights to their children, get a bank account, et cetera, et cetera. So these issues were providing some commonality across the right to left divide, and the biggest one of all was, and I can't remember the year, Roma Mitchell did the rape and sexual assault law reform. Now, I reckon that was somewhere around like 75, 76. It was somewhere in this 70s period. But I can tell you, rape was the uniting thing for women across the spectrum, because conservative women knew about rape as much as the radical women did. And, you know, there might be differences on exactly how you deal with it, but there was a commonality. So there was a spirit of wanting to come together. I have to tell you, the worst thing about Dame Roma's wonderful work on those laws was that the first case that happened after those laws, when she'd done all this wonderful stuff, and it was a young woman, I don't know, 15, 16, 17, something like that. And the defence tried to raise her past sexual history, and Roma agreed. Oh! Anyway.
So there's a growing awareness, a real underground movement, you might say.
Well,
so,
a certain level of women as a community want a fair go. They want stuff. They've got legitimate needs, and how are we going to get it? So I started to build in my mind a picture. And in the process of doing that, there were some key interviews that I had. Marion Disney was one of them. I went and interviewed Jo Wilmot, who was at the Institute of Aboriginal Studies, which is the kind of early precursor. No, not Jo Wilmot. Marianne Binsalik. Jo came later. Jo was the first Aboriginal worker. Marianne Binsalik was the director, I think, or the coordinator, whatever it was called, of the Institute of Aboriginal Studies. And she then, because that, of course, became part of University of South Australia, and she ended her working career as a professor of Aboriginal Studies at the University of South Australia. Marianne Binsalik was extraordinary, and she was very confronting for me, because she really pointed out for me the difference between family violence and how Aboriginal women saw the remedies. That it could never, the violence could never be disassociated from the dispossession and the systemic racism. And so that was a whole other growth period for me. I went and met with, this is embarrassing that these names do not easily come
to
my mind.
It's quite a long time ago, Andy. I think it can be forgiven.
But there's, and her name will come back to me. She was great. She was a real information expert. Margaret Wagstaff? I think. Anyway, she was great, learned a lot about information, because, of course, through all this, I'm thinking, I am not an information officer's bootlace. I've never been trained, like, what? And then, and I also met with the women at Law Court. I met with Nisha Makata, who was the head of the National Women's Council, and I just asked these women, you know, some, I don't know, I was building this idea in my mind. And then I went down to the Citizens Advice Bureau in Port Adelaide and I met Rosalind Johnson. And I knew within 10 minutes of getting there that this was the linchpin of the switchboard. This was the person who, like, my plan coalesced around Rosalind, because she absolutely understood where I was coming from. She had very similar, let's just say, values. She knew the reality of women's lives in the same ways that I did. She was very clever, and critically, she was an information officer and she was far more stable than me. I knew that at some point, you know, I didn't see myself having a lifetime thing here. I knew that I was interested for a while, but I'd get bored. What I didn't know is that Marion Disney had also realised how brilliant Rosalind was, and that Rosalind was her preferred successor for the Citizens Advice Bureau. And I have to say, it is, you know, profound gratitude to Marion Disney that she never held it against me, because, you know, really, in that first meeting, we hatched the beginning of a plan that Rosalind would leave the Citizens Advice Bureau if I could get something going. And it's still something going. It's still this amorphous thing. So back into the Women's Advisory Unit. And Deborah was exactly the right kind of manager for me at that stage, because really, she paid no attention. I mean, she sort of did. She was very busy with the business of government, and you know, she was dealing with ministers, and I would feed up to her particular cases that needed her to go and deal with. And, you know, she was doing all that, and she was, you know, doing all this proper work, as we thought of it in some ways.
Did you have interference from, say, Don Dunstan or those members? Well, was she keeping them off your back, perhaps?
No. At this stage, I am just an information officer in the Premier's Department. And the nearest thing I did was that got me into trouble was bring in my tiny nephew, the one that was in the accident with my sister, who was on my desk being changed when gorgeous man he was too, the CEO of the Premier's Department, came to visit. And he was a lovely man. He had two girls and, you know, went to clock Matthew under the chin. Matthew pissed in his face as I was changing his nappy. That was very funny. But, yeah, no. I was just I wasn't on anybody's radar at this point. But I was about to put myself there. Because I'm not complaining about Deborah's management style. I don't know that the switchboard would ever have happened if it had been somebody who micromanaged. Deborah trusted her staff to do the work they were supposed to do. What she knew was that I was answering the phone, I was treating this phone call seriously, I was feeding up the ones that needed to happen, and all she was hearing was good feedback. So that was okay. I went to see Maureen Fallon now. She was the one who had conducted the interview and actually appointed me into that role and taken that first phone call. And I had a lot of time for Maureen. She was complete opposite to me. She was a librarian, I think, by training. She was very proper as a public servant. But she was a wheeler and dealer in her own way. Like, she knew everybody. She paid serious attention to what was happening. She always knew where the money was, the grants, etc., etc. And I think I got to a point in my thinking where I needed to just see if there was a way to go forward with this. So I can't even remember how I put the idea to her, but I remember her response, which was to say, Don Dunstan has just released these fabulous grants. I forget what they were called. It was some, because Dunstan did this amazing revitalisation of the whole state library system, and he offered grants, I think it was like $10,000, for community groups, because they wanted, and this was a, there was a link to information, you know, libraries information, and it was specifically around information anyway. So she said, why don't we put in an application? So thank goodness she helped me with it. And we put it in and we got it. And so at this point, I think Deborah's overseas.
So she didn't know anything about it at the start.
Oh, she sort of did, yeah. And, you know, she's approving everything and signing everything. But, you know, I think her head's busy in a bigger world. And I can't remember the exact timing and all this stuff. If you really want the exact, you've got to go to Maureen, because she's, Deborah's very forgetful these days. Scrub that from the tape, from the transcript. I'll just say that she...
So your grant was for your unit or for you and Maureen?
It was for the Women's Advisory Unit to set up. We might even have come up with the name straight away, the Women's Information Switchboard, as under, yeah, that's what it was. And so with the $10,000, this amazing... grant that I can't remember the name of that they employed me on initially was how I was able to employ staff. Maureen and I worked that out. So I worked out I could employ, I think it was 5 women, and Maureen helped me negotiate with the library the lease of the institute, that we could be in that space. And I can't even remember what the, you know, like, did we lease it? I don't think we did. I think we just could be in it.
Is this the premises in Kintore Avenue?
Yes.
Exactly. Yes. So it was there exactly. You started, yes. Where you started. Yeah.
And Valmé Henkel was the state librarian at the time. It'd be great to get her recollections on this, because I'm sure she'd have a much better recollection than I do. And of course, Deborah was involved in those negotiations and signing and what have you. But I think it was really, it was me and Maureen who, you know, talked about how it was going to be. And in particular, I was making it up as I was going along. Absolutely. So, you know, like Valmé would ask a question, and I'd have the answer there. So things like, how would we deal with children in there? And I said, well, we will have a play space. I hadn't thought of that, but I knew absolutely, if we're having women coming in, we're having kids coming in, there will be play space. Where will I get the toys and what have you? Will we have a childcare worker? No, we'll get all the toys donated and we'll construct it so it's a perfectly safe space. You know, I'd just make it up. It's hilarious because a little bit later on when we were safely in there, oh no, that's right. Now, that's right, the issue about children. So, if children are going to be there and going to be running around, then there is a great concern that they might shake the floors and dust will go down into the archives. How will we guard against that? And
you hadn't thought of that, had you?
No, absolutely I hadn't. And some of these questions, you know, were kind of like, and there were other library people there. And in fact, I've got a feeling that the gentleman who was in charge of the archives under down below asked that question. And I've got a feeling nobody else in the room had thought of it either. And I said, quick as a flash, we will have the best quality carpet with a lot of underfelt. I do remember Maureen going, what? Now, this is where Mary Beasley comes into this story. She was, what was her role? She was, Now, I know she was the Commissioner for Equal Opportunity. I'm not sure if she was in that role at that moment, but she was, you know, she was a serious bigwig. I've got another 20 minutes. Is that okay? Okay, cool. Deborah McCulloch was overseas. She'd gone on some women's advisor thing. And this, we've got to this moment in time where we've got the premises and we've got to get in there, you know, because possession is 9/10 of the law. And because I'm doing all this negotiating to get staff, I'm doing everything at the same time with no idea what I'm doing. And Mary Beasley, bless her, came up with this wonderful idea. Because remember, I need good quality carpet with a lot of felt. Mary discovered that some department somewhere was recarpeting. And she managed to get, for free, this proper, beautiful carpet with the felt and what have you. And we did a little test run with the archivists. And they declared themselves happy. We had children. We invited children in to come around and run. And they stood underneath with pieces of clean paper to test if the dust came down.
Isn't that a superb example of how a woman deals with something? Thinking on your feet and sorting the problem.
Thinking on your feet and working as a group. Like, you know, it was extraordinary, this whole bit. And, like, without Maureen and Mary and other people, it would never have happened. So anyway, then there's a few other really key things now. So we kind of got in there and we planned for this launch and what have you. Now, I can't remember the absolute accuracy of this, but it was so much my gleeful feeling at the time that I suspect I'm absolutely accurate in saying that on the day, okay, so I have this recollection, I think it's accurate, that on the day the Premier launched the switchboard, there was not in existence a piece of paper that actually authorised it coming into being in the fashion in which it did. Now, just before we launched it, remember I'm tracking around all the women's organisations and notable women, like women who had a lot of smarts. And Betty Fisher, who was for very many years a communist, she came out of the printer's trade. I completely don't remember what she was involved in. She was part of some women's group or something. I don't know. I don't even really recollect how I knew Betty. And she was very much older than me. But I absolutely remember being captivated by some of her stories. And I had gone to her and said, this is what I'm planning to do. What do you think? A bit of a think. And she said, right, well, that's a good idea. I like that. She said, now, to make it last, that's the challenge. She said, don't doubt you. You're a bright young thing. You're putting it all together. You'll get it happening. But you have to think about how it's going to last. And I thought, well, yes, that's a good idea. I like that plan. And I said, do you have some ideas? Thank goodness I asked that question. Because, of course, Betty did have an idea. And she said, yes, absolutely. What you need to create is the Women's Information Switchboard Support Group. And you need every women's group on it. And we created the Women's Information Switchboard Support Group. And we had Mary Gallagher was leading the Liberal Party women's group. Marion Disney from the Citizens Advice Bureau, Paola from Bloor Court, the Radical Lesbians, and so on, so on, so on. There was, I think, 30 organisations. And Betty said, if you have all the women's organisations on it, and you have the complete spectrum and you always work with those women, then no government will ever undo it.
What a superb idea. What terrific support.
What a superb idea. Now, one of the other critical things to tell, because I'm not sure other people... What I'm trying to do is tell the bits I'm not sure other people will...
And you're doing a splendid job with that. That's
okay.
Terrific.
The other bit, as far as I was concerned, that was utterly key to all of this was as the idea was really starting to take shape in my mind, I thought, okay, so I can use this government program to get some paid workers, but I don't know how long that program will last, and I wasn't sure that I was quite sure we could have one position, and I knew that as soon as possible I would vacate that, and that would be Roslyn. That was very clear in my mind. She was the only person that I had met who had the capability. She was definitely the right one. So I knew there'd be one paid position. But I thought, what happens if everything, you know, like if all those other positions disappear, then how's this going to run? It's going to have to run. And so I trucked myself around at that time, you might remember, in women's colleges and TAFEs and neighbourhood houses, etc., there were these little women's studies groups everywhere, women's health classes and women's martial arts classes and what have you. So I went everywhere and I talked about this. And I particularly remember, I think it was a women's studies group at the college up in Panorama, a woman called Liz ran it. I can't remember her surname for the moment. There was an amazing group of women. And there was a mother and daughter combination there. It was Pat Rowe and her daughter, Chrissy. And Pat Rowe at that stage must have been... It's hard because I was only 25, so, you know, probably anybody who's over 40 looked old. But I reckon Pat was probably at least 50, maybe closer to 60, I don't remember. But she was, you know, one of those women... The gravelly voice from long time smoking. She was a Catholic mother of six. There were no flies on Pat. She had every experience known to women. And so she led the questioning. My goodness, talk about being grilled. I thought anything I'd had up to that point was easy peasy. Answering Pat was amazing. And at the end of it, she said, right. So she said, when having got every bit of everything out of me, including my terror that these jobs would go. So she said, right. So what you need to do, set this up on a volunteer model. Now, you're going to have to do that properly. You better go and learn about how to do that properly. Because if you do it properly, then we'll run it for you when the paid workers go. So have you got a piece of paper for us to sign up? And she was the first volunteer to sign up. And several of those other women in that course signed up that day. They gave me their address and their phone number. And they said, as soon as you're ready, let us know. We're here. And at that point, I thought, she's exactly right. And I've just remembered Margaret Wagstaff not only was brilliant on information, but Joy Noble. And I forget how Margaret was tied into it. But anyway, volunteers. Joy Noble was writing all the stuff on volunteers and volunteer essay, I think. I don't know if it was called that then, but it was happening. And it was this beginning of thinking, part of the women's consciousness. Like, it's all very well to be the lavender ladies, but hold on. How do we get to be volunteers and have our expertise recognised? And that was the point. Because by now I'd clearly articulated right from the beginning the philosophy this was going to run on. And it was going to be that information is power. And women often need assistance and support to put that information into practice. And that is where the advocacy role sits, both individual and systemic. Right? So I had that very clear. And now, with Pat's confrontation and suggestion, I thought, and of course, that's the other thing. this can't work without the full diversity of the women's community. If we've got one Greek woman, one Italian woman, etc., which is, you know, kind of how I set it up, that, you know, like one young Greek woman doesn't represent the whole, you know, so you need to have that broader diversity. You get that from volunteers, but it's not fair to exploit women because this is serious work, and I knew perfectly well how much serious work it was. So I constructed the volunteer program, and I did it on the basis that we ran first-class training for the volunteers, that there was a really good support program for volunteers so that they really got to do good stuff and to extend their capabilities. And when they went for paid work, we would give them a fabulous reference. And so very quickly what we discovered was that we created quite a high turnover amongst the women, the young women who were returning to work after having babies and what have you, and underpinned by the older women who made that utter passionate commitment. People like Pat Rowe, Merl Tonkin, Rita Shortland from the UN Women's Peace and what have you. Okay, so I know we're running out of time, so a couple of other really critical stories. Once we got this up and running, just about the time of the launching, either immediately before or immediately after, I agreed to go on radio and television, more radio than television, but both, and talk about it. And two interviews in particular stand out in my mind, Philip Satchell and Jeremy Cordeau. Both quite confronting in some ways. These were, you know, male gurus of, you know, they're the shock jocks of their time. Mm-hmm. Or Philip was probably more, you know, Jeremy Cordeau was a bit confrontational. He was a bit of a shock jock. But they were both men who were very confronted, as a lot of men were, by this whole idea of this whole thing for women only. And so, you know, I got on and I did this, about why, da, 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 da. And both of them neither listened to the other, because the second one would never have done it if he'd heard the response to the first one. Both of them said to me, so what did women, how did women manage before we had this sort of switchboard? And first time I was asked that question, what am I going to say to that? And had the wit to say, Philip, why don't you open the lines and ask your listeners? Oh, thank goodness I did. And I tell you what, if you could ever get recordings of those interviews, you would find they are striking. I can't remember exactly in which order and which interview, but the first callers on the line in both instances were really old women. And I remember one woman got on and said, Jeremy, I'll tell you how women managed before this young woman came along. And she told this horrific story of domestic violence, which even thinking about now, just like I sat in that studio, like just listening to this woman's experience. And she was a country woman. And she had rung in because somewhere in the interview, he had elicited the fact I came from the country. And she said, so you'll understand what I'm talking about. And she told the story and you know, the beatings and her and the children and the cart. Anyway, so, and that opened the flood. Other women just rang in.
Leap of faith on your behalf that people would ring in. And they did.
Well, having grown up in the country, and particularly with my grandparents, I listened to the radio because we didn't have television, and I knew that, particularly the ABC, I knew people would ring in on certain talk shows. So, I mean, my family never had, but I knew they did.
That seems remarkable to me. that you've done that, and that's a marvellous thing. So what did they say? What did Jeremy and...
Oh, completely shut them up. They became very respectful. Very respectful because they absolutely understood, I think, in a way that I could never have told them. You know, I was, you know, and from to be fair, there are these blokes who are, both of them would have been, you know, men in their prime. They're, you know, they're serious professionals, and they take one look at this mad redhead kid, really. I mean, you know, I wasn't a kid, I was 25, but, you know, who takes seriously a 25-year-old with all these bright ideas is going to change the world? That was not common for, you know, in that time. And so I'd never have been able to convince them that women in South Australia had an experience that most men had no idea of. That was what attracted women to the Women's Information Switchboard in those early days. That's what they responded to. When I asked that question, the subliminal thing was I was talking about real lives of women. And I was talking not in any... there was no charity in it. I was always very clear that this was about women had a right to information. And that was part of the whole Don Dunstan thing about the libraries and the right to information. I'm very clear about that. And that it was quite difficult for women to access information. You know, to go into a big government department or into a bank where everybody was male, and if you came from the country or you came from the suburbs, if you didn't feel like you had an education, and a lot of women were still, you know, like, I mean, I was the generation that was finishing school, going to university, but a lot of my mother's generation finished school at 13, 14. So if you then had to go and argue your case to somebody who had a professional education and was a man to boot. So it was the right to information, and we recognised that in many instances, like going to court or what have you, women will need support, and it will be peer support. This is not about providing you with professional social workers. If you need a social worker or you need a doctor, we'll refer you to those people, because that's part of helping you understand what is available. And if there are enough women having the same sorts of experiences, then we will ask the Women's Advisory Unit to take that issue on. And, you know, some of those issues around violence, family law, social security, women's accommodation later on became a very big issue. Did go up to the switchboard for that kind of systemic thing, but it was not a charity, and women in South Australia liked the idea, and that is why the switchboard was successful, I think.
And it's been absolutely remarkable talking to you. You've really opened up all those things that we've wondered about, and I just would like to say to you that you should be very, very pleased that really the Women's Information Service, which the name was changed from the switchboard.
Oh, of course it has, yes.
And that has really carried on the basis of those thoughts that you've talked about, the volunteering and the ethics behind it have really been carried on to this day. So you should be very proud of that, and I'm very proud to
Wasn't
have met
Betty's
you.
Wasn't Betty's idea a brilliant one, though? Because she was right. She was the one who foresaw, actually, it could last.
Yes, it's wonderful. But you were the one that took it up and ran with it. So thank you very much for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
Cool. Thank you.